We begin this morning with the ceremonial swearing-in of new members of the bar of the U.S. Court of Appeals to the District of Columbia. You started drawing a good crowd for you. On behalf of myself and my colleagues, not only Judge Kavanaugh and Judge Ginsburg who are with us, but the colleagues who are back in their chambers preparing for other days, I want to welcome you to this attorney admission ceremony. Before you appear before the court, we like to think that you might familiarize yourself some with the history of the court. It was formed by an act of Congress on February 9th of 1893, originally called the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia. The court comprised then a Chief Justice instead of Chief Judge. Oh, it had a more important title in those days. And there were two associate justices. It was not until 1948 that the court received its present name. The court has gone from 3 to 12 authorized judgeships, then back down to 11, which where it now consists. We have 8 of those 11 seats currently filled, along with 5 very busy senior judges. Of the 57 judges who've served on this court, 7 have gone on to serve on the Supreme Court. Chief Justices Roberts, Berger, and Vinson, and Justices Rutledge, Scalia, Thomas, and Ruth Ginsburg. To celebrate the 200th anniversary of the creation of the first court in the District of Columbia, Circuit's Historical Society commissioned historian Jeffrey Brandon Morris to write a scholarly history of the circuit. The result was the awkwardly titled Calmly to Poise the Scales of Justice, a history of the courts of the District of Columbia Circuit, which convinces me that this historian really dislikes split infinities. I encourage you to read the book. Some people have. And what truly makes this a great special court is the members of the bar and the bench. The bar of this circuit is made up of some of the most highly regarded and skilled advocates in the country. Our bar members have a history of providing pro bono service that enables the court to do its work more effectively when we need to know that the parties are receiving good legal representation. I hope you'll all consider participating in the court's pro bono programs. I'm sure you've worked very hard to get here, and you take pride in what you've achieved, and you should do so. And as you move forward, I hope you'll take a moment to look back and thank those of your family and friends and society who've helped you get here. And we hope that you will help others to achieve the same. I'm particularly pleased to see some of the law clerks among the group being sworn in today. It's been a pleasure to work with you over the past year, and I eagerly await your return to this court as counsel. To all of you being sworn in today, we look forward to your appearance before the court. We know you will serve well the cause of justice in the D.C. Circuit. Madam Clerk. Repeat after me. I state your name.
I
do solemnly swear
that
I will conduct myself as an attorney and counselor of this court uprightly and according to law, and that I will support the Constitution of the United States. Thank you for coming to the bar of this court. You are now members, attorneys, counselors at law, and entitled to the rights and privileges appertaining thereto. Let it be spread upon the records of the court that the named persons are now so entitled and so esteemed. Thank you very much. Congratulations. Thank you. morning, counsel.
My name is Sanford Pittler. I am an attorney with the law firm of Bennett Bigelow and Leadham in Seattle, Washington, and we represent the appellant in this case. Your Honor, Your Honors, I've practiced in the Medicare area for 25 years. This is my last argument. And I can tell you honestly that I have a great fear in this case, which has two issues, two separate decisions by Judge Lamberth below on completely different issues. And my fear is that the lack of ground-level understanding of how Medicare cost reports and the Medicare system works may lead this court to defer rather than understanding that this first issue, this hold harmless issue, is actually a slam dunk for the hospitals, for the hospital. And when I say that, it's because there's a single factual issue at play here, just one. The program memorandum in question, A9962, adopted in December of 1999 and effective January 1st of 2000, basically instructs Medicare intermediaries to include expansion, waiver, Medicaid expansion waiver days in the DSH calculation, even though the Secretary's policy since 1996 excluded those days. You get to get them included if you meet one requirement, that you appeal the exclusion of those days prior to 10-1-99. Here, the hospital appealed in 1998, early in 1998. The hospital appealed five issues, all worded identically in terms of appealing an audit adjustment, all five issues. One of those issues was appealing the effect of audit adjustment number 49. So the only question before you here is, was the appeal of audit adjustment number 49 related to the exclusion of expansion waiver days?
The question really is, how specific do you need to be in appealing the particular issue? You clearly raised 49. I think what this is going to turn on is the specificity that's required by the program memo.
The program, well, if you start with the analysis and roadmap that Judge Robertson used in the St. Joseph's case in the D.C. District Court, right? He said you don't have to use any magic words, right? You're asking, if one were to say you had to use the express words exclusion of expansion waiver days.
Well, it's not so much magic words, but there were a lot of things included in issue in adjustment 49.
Incorrect.
Well,
that's incorrect, Your Honor. I'm sorry. The facts
I think it's correct. There.
Can I show you why that's not correct?
How many are there? There are five or six things wrapped up in that, correct?
No, there's one thing.
Okay.
The whole adjustment concerns Medicaid eligible days. There is nothing else that adjustment does.
I understand that, but okay. The expansion issue is only one of several issues, correct?
No, in fact, the only issue in that adjustment that you would appeal is the expansion.
Is there anything other than expansion waiver days in adjustment 49?
Not that anybody would appeal. I'll tell you exactly.
Whoa. What is that?
That's a yes.
Not that anybody would appeal. The answer to Judge Kavanaugh's question should be yes, shouldn't it? That there are other things included.
There are other days that were disallowed.
For different, right.
But for reasons that this hospital would never have appealed.
Right. Okay. I get that. But my original question was just that adjustment 49 included things other than expansion waiver days. This doesn't mean you're wrong. I'm just trying to get the facts straight. And the question is, by not naming expansion waiver days, I understand the government's argument to be, by not specifically listing expansion waiver days, that you have a problem. Now, I'm going to press them, too. Don't worry.
I'm not sure. Well, I don't understand the problem. Let me explain why.
Okay?
The intermediary, you know, we had an evidentiary hearing before the PRRB, right? The hospital presented a fact witness, their reimbursement manager. The intermediary didn't produce any witness, right, regarding this, I believe, because an intermediary witness, somebody who actually works in this, would have to concede that the hospital appealed the expansion waiver days. The only person who appeared was an attorney. But the attorney testified at the very end of the hearing in response to a question from board member Blodgett. Question. So, audit adjustment number 49 did involve the waiver days then. Is that what you're saying? Mr. Grimes, this is the attorney for the intermediary, it excludes the waiver days. It excluded the waiver days the provider included in its cost report. Mr. Grimes, I'm not certain it excluded the waiver days that were included in the cost report, but it certainly, it excluded any waiver days from the calculation. So what we have here, and that fact, that two facts, that the hospital included 811, which we showed you how you get to 811 in the reply brief, and I can do it for you here if you want, 811 expansion waiver days were included in the as-filed cost report. The Medicaid-eligible days serve as part of the basis for the $3.4 million claimed in DSH payments in the as-filed cost report.
Now, what about the 75,000 figure? Because that's the other thing that was relied on. That,
the inference,
that was a botch, right, to put 75,000?
Absolutely not. My apologies, right? But remember, 25 years of doing this.
That's why I'm asking. But the number, you put $75,000 in the original thing, and then it spikes to 600 and something.
No.
No?
It didn't?
No. That's what I'm trying to.
I read the same 75,000 in the same place in the same spec you got.
But that's my point, is I can, because.
We don't get your point then.
Okay. Well, let me try and give it to you. Number one. Testimony in the record, uncontroverted, by Mr. Trower, the witness for Baptist Memphis, explained that the $75,000 was simply a plug number. It's a number that you use because you do not know the exact value of what the appeal is going to produce.
It's a placeholder, right?
Correct.
But it's not a, in this case, you, they say, and you're going to tell
sure,
me why this is
fine.
Wrong, but they say they were thrown off or misled, or you couldn't really have been appealing the expansion waiver days because 75,000 was so obviously the wrong figure.
And there was no asterisk. My bank does that, put placeholders for some transactions, and they put asterisks or they put explanations, and nothing that says this is a placeholder.
You have to view this in terms of what the PRB required at the time to file an appeal. If you look at the appeal, I explained to you there were five issues appealed. One of the issues, the bed count, bed day issue, was worth over $2 million. And the same $75,000 plug number was used to appeal that issue.
You mean to say it was used by you?
By the hospital, exactly. Well, the hospital has
to... And there are different figures for the three of the other ones. Why is that?
One of them
is 1.8
they're
million.
They're all based on the amount of the adjustment.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Except... Some adjustments you can tell exactly that if you reverse them, that's what is going to be the value.
Is it your practice when you have need a placeholder always to use $75,000?
This hospital used $75,000 as testified by
I did in this
Trower.
Case.
I didn't. The appeals I've filed don't use $75,000. They just use $10,000 because that's the statutory minimum that an appeal has to put into play.
That one would make a lot more sense.
Yeah.
The 75,000 is...
It's a no, well, each hospital uses a different number. I mean, the fact
well,
is
you're... How is anyone looking at that supposed to know that it's a placeholder? Now, I can see...
Because the adjustment
using
was...
the statutory minimum, I do not see the thinking on using the 75.
Well, I'm... Okay. You're comparing the $75,000 to the $625,000 of the reduction.
No, we're not comparing it. We're looking one place and seeing that, and looking another place and seeing the other.
I understand, but the $625,000 reflects the exclusion of a variety of numbers of days. Each day excluded is worth $284. The adjustment, the $625,000, almost $400,000 of it deals with exclusion or disallowance of days that the hospital itself already tried to disallow. Only $230,000 relate to the possible 811 days that are expansion waiver. So if you only have $230,000 at issue, right, and they were not audited, so you don't know how many are actually going to be thrown out by the intermediary, using $75,000 is a pretty sound number to use, because you're not really appealing all $625,000. Because the intermediary disallowed 1,390 some odd days. 38 from a pre-TennCare Tennessee case claim where it was a 62-day stay and the patient was only Medicaid eligible for 24 days. The rest were reflection of the exclusion of psych days, SNF days, Medicare crossover days. If you look at the letter from the hospital to the intermediary in February of 1997, the hospital says, we've already tried to exclude those days. They would never appeal the further identification and disallowance of those days because they themselves tried to exclude them. The other days that were disallowed are days that were paid by Mississippi, which were already included in the 1,793 out-of-state Medicaid days, which the intermediary allowed at 100%. So the 1,358 days that were excluded for reasons that have nothing to do with an appeal leaves the 811 days from the hospital's 14,118 days that were included in the as-filed cost report. So one can say, well, it didn't use the exact words. But in fact, the factual reality here is the testimony by the intermediary's own representative makes it clear that the appeal of Order Adjustment 49 in fact appealed the exclusion of expansion waiver days.
Let me just summarize it, because it named Adjustment 49, and that alone from your perspective is good enough, and beyond that it would have been obvious that nothing else was being appealed but the expansion waiver days to anyone who had a clue.
It wouldn't matter. What was appealed is the disallowance of days, right. And that Audit Adjustment 49 did nothing else but disallow days, including 811 expansion waiver days. My apologies, Your Honor, but there's another whole issue from a whole completely different decision by Judge Lamberth that is supposed to be
argued. Add 3 minutes to his opening time, and then we'll see about rebuttal later. You can go ahead, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, the other issue concerned a filing of an exception request with respect to the routine cost limitations on payments to skilled nursing facilities. In this case, the hospital had a skilled nursing unit in the hospital. And the facts are very clear and not disputed. When the hospital filed its cost report, it filed it using on the basis of the home office cost statement that was also filed. The intermediary disallowed that statement and used costs from a prior fiscal year. And so at the time the intermediary finalized that cost report, both the intermediary and the hospital knew that that cost report was inaccurate. Now, to file an atypical service exception request, it affects a myriad of costs for the SNF. 12 cost categories, 10 of which were going to change as a result of the revised NPR. What we are asking you to do is put yourself in the shoes of the hospital. Go and look at 42 CFR 413.30C, which is the exception request regulation. It simply says you have to file your exception request within 180 days of an NPR. There is absolutely no limitation in the language of the regulation with respect to filing an exception request from a revised NPR.
True, but isn't it reasonable to sit for HHS to say that if you haven't done it the first time around, you can't bring up new issues when challenging the revised? Why isn't that a reasonable interpretation?
New issues? I'm sorry. This is an exception request. This is not an appeal of an RNPR. Those are two completely different regimes. Okay, that's what's wrong with what went on in this case. The exception request, had they done it from the original NPR, would have been $1.2 million in the record intermediary's own testimony, right? Everyone knew that was incorrect. In fact, the full exception request filed from the revised NPR was only $750,000. So basically what the government is saying is, well, you should have filed from the original NPR, even though there's no requirement in the regulations, right? But the hospital's saying, well, if we did that, we would be filing something that was totally inaccurate. In fact, the revised NPR affected 10 of the 12 categories of costs, and if you just based the value of the exception request on the costs adjusted in the RNPR, the exception request would be worth $350,000. Okay, so even if you wanted to say, oh, well, it's okay for the secretary to interpret this regulation to completely change it, which is exactly what they've done. They've completely changed the regulation that was in place at the time of the finalized cost report, at the time of the revised cost report, at the time that the hospital filed its exception request. How did they change it? They changed it, and you can look on page 300 of Judge Lambert's decision, right? They changed it to say, well, it really means initial NPR, right? But if you're going to do it from a revised NPR, then you couldn't be entitled to have an exception from the original NPR. You could only do it in the revised NPR if you became newly eligible. That's a complete rewriting of a regulation. You know, the Foothill case, the Ninth Circuit case, it's a fascinating case. That case concerned a 1983 fiscal year. That hospital tried to pull off an exception request, right, in the TEFRA system, it's a different system, by filing an exception request from a second RNPR that was 6 years later. Okay? And that RNPR didn't adjust any costs that would be impacted by an exception request. And the CMS, or the HCFA, changed the regulation at issue there in 1993 and stuck in the word initial NPR. So the case that came before the Ninth Circuit and its decision issued in 1998 is, in my view, a manufactured interpretation solely for litigation, given that the fact that the Secretary changed the regulation at issue to a completely different view.
We've actually gone well past your second time allotment now, so I will, unless my colleagues have further questions, we'll hear from the government.
Okay.
Seeing none, we'll hear from the appellee.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel. We'll consider giving you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal after the government. Since I gave him 18 minutes, bump her up to 18, but we'll advise you that that's a maximum, not a minimum. You know that.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor. I'm Stephanie Marcus from the Department of Justice, and I represent appellee Kathleen Sebelius. What plaintiff is asking this court to do is to read a crucial phrase out of the program memorandum, which is that the appeal must be on the issue of the exclusion of these types of days, which in this case is the expansion days. This, in the appeal, they just filed a general blanket dish appeal, and that is not sufficient.
But they did file it on, they specifically list Adjustment 49, and the expansion waiver days are encompassed within Adjustment 49. So if the issue is certainly presented.
Well, Your Honor, I think that
this is not, for example, let me give you, if they were raising an issue now that had been an Adjustment 50, and they had only appealed Adjustment 49, well, you win, obviously. That's something different. It's not an appeal on the issue. But when they've raised Adjustment 49, and this is one of the parts of Adjustment 49, I don't see what the problem is. This is not supposed to be some trap, right? This is just raise the issue.
Like
the notice of appeal, and to analogize the rules of appellate procedure, you just have to identify the decision appealed from. You don't have to go into all the arguments you're going to raise.
Well, Your Honor, actually, I have several answers to that. Okay. One is just on Adjustment 49 itself. That would be, first of all, in Adjustment 49, because these expansion days were excluded prior to the actual audit, all that was adjusted were the other days that ended up being excluded from the dish calculation. In any event, but regardless, even assuming everything were encompassed, the citation to Adjustment 49 is no better than the general dish appeal, because all of those other days are also reflected in Adjustment 49, which would be, for example, the exclusion of crossover days, days paid by other states.
Sure, but within that is the expansion waiver days.
Well, not again. We do dispute.
You disagree with that.
Yes, and the when counsel was quoting from the intermediary representative's testimony, one part that was left out, which is on Joint Appendix page 92, he says, he said that these days were excluded, and they were excluded prior to the actual audit of the numbers per the instructions of the intermediary, which was you need to take out the expansion days from the log of days that we are going to audit. So yes, to the extent it was showing the final dish adjustment, it could reflect the exclusion of those days, but what the intermediary's representative said, but there was no adjustment to those numbers. And in
the first sentence says the intermediary incorrectly calculated the disproportionate share adjustment.
Yes, that could be for any number of reasons. The hospital might have wanted to challenge the exclusion of crossover days, which crossover days relate to days attributable to patients who are dual eligible for Medicare and Medicaid. They could contest on factual basis days that were assigned, that the intermediary found were attributable to a psych unit or to other states. I mean, it's not clear, and the burden shouldn't be on the secretary to try to figure out what they are appealing. This is a hold harmless policy that the secretary instituted to distinguish between those hospitals that had a genuine reliance interest on receiving these payments and those that didn't. And if you look at the program memorandum, you'll see that a large part of it is dedicated to discussing hospitals that have already received payments for these types of days. They already got payments, and they're instructing intermediaries not to seek to recoup those payments. And then for those hospitals like plaintiff who haven't in the past, have not actually received payment, they have to file, have to have filed an appeal on the issue of the exclusion of these types of days.
Right, you're trying to prevent gaming the system by people pretending they had appealed something that they hadn't really appealed, right?
Yes, and the program memorandum makes that clear by saying you can't add that issue after October 15th. And I would say the regulations that govern requests for a hearing from the board do provide that the provider must identify the aspects of the determination with which the provider is dissatisfied, explain why the provider believes the determination is incorrect in such particulars, and be accompanied by it. So it's not quite like a notice of appeal.
Were you reading from the rule in place at the time?
This is 1998, and their appeal was filed. This is the addendum to our brief.
Right.
It's 42 CFR 405-1841.
The rules now, at least as I understand them, have been amended to deal with this issue, because now framing issues for adjustments involving multiple components, which sounds like what this is, and now the rules say when there are multiple components, you need to specifically identify the items in dispute. But that wasn't true back in 98, right?
But it was certainly
back in 98, if you just named the adjustment.
Though the regulation in place.
And the reason why it was.
Right. It just names the adjustment. And it also, as Your Honor pointed out in questioning opposing counsel, it gives an amount of $75,000. And if you look, they didn't use $75,000 as the amount in three of the five appeal issues. In three of the five appeal issues, they have figures that are much larger than that. So this isn't a case of a hospital that uses $10,000.
Is it common for hospitals to use placeholder numbers in this kind of situation?
I don't know, Your Honor, but since the jurisdictional amount is $10,000, that would seem to be illogical.
It would be very odd that there would, if this is common, that there would not be some alert placed on the number that this is not really what we're talking about. This is a placeholder, is it?
But you
see these often enough to have an idea whether that is?
I think looking at the plaintiff's appeal itself, just the fact that they had different numbers for most of these, and some of them, you know, are, again, much greater than 75,000. The fact that after October 15th, 1999, they increased the amount so greatly, I think, is probative. And I think the district court correctly deferred to the secretary and found that the secretary's decision was reasonable.
What else within Adjustment 49 do you think they reasonably could have been appealing?
Your Honor,
because
again,
without that, it seems you have to have a theory for that, I think, or else.
Your Honor, I think that going to what the Seventh Circuit said in Rush University Medical Center in rejecting a provider's argument, it's that these disputes over inferences that can be drawn from a general appeal that maybe just cites one adjustment that eliminates lots of different categories of days show why a specific appeal is required for hold harmless treatment. It's not required for them to appeal the issue. It's required to benefit from the hold harmless policy. And again, you know, they went ahead with their appeal. They're before this court. They didn't lose the chance to appeal anything, but they can't get the substantive right
to
hold harmless.
Do they have any relief if they don't come within the hold harmless? I mean,
it's
a theoretical right to appeal, but unless there's
if
they're outside the hold harmless doctrine, what good would it do them to appeal?
But, Your Honor, they also, in this case in Cookeville, they also raised the legal issue, which they lost on as well. But in
this is the one we have to decide.
Yes. But in any event, what the Seventh Circuit said is it's not that you don't have the magic words, it's that there are no synonyms for the right words or even similes or metaphors. There's no indication on the face of that appeal what the hospital is appealing. And this court has had quite a few DSH adjustment appeals that it's heard. So the court, I think, can take note of the fact that there are a number of different DSH issues that providers appeal on, not just expansion days.
Explore that a little, because they do mention Adjustment 49, as we've discussed. When you look at Adjustment 49, which is attached, it references the T-100. And when you look at the T-100 and the T-110 document form, I'm not sure I'm using the right word, you know clearly from looking at those two things that the issue here is the expansion waiver days. It takes about 30 seconds to wind your way from one document to another to figure out what's really at issue. Am I missing something?
If you look at the adjustment itself, which is of course all that they cited in their appeal.
Right, okay, but the attachment has this left column that says T-100, at least as I read it.
Well,
and then when you go to the T-100, again, correct me if I'm on the wrong document, you then have the calculation of days and the 10 care days, which are the key, I guess. And then when you look at that document, you figure out that, again, correct me if I'm wrong, I think you figure out that expansion waiver days are the issue. So you can get there pretty quickly.
Well, the work papers that that we have here that from the intermediary,
mm-hmm.
okay? And now I am looking at pages, okay, you have T-100, which is Joint Appendix 126.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure where, if you, in here, that you're getting that the only thing that was excluded was expansion days, because if you look further at the other related work papers to T-100, mm-hmm. And now I'm on JA 129 mm-hmm. and 130, they have a total errors column on 130.
Mm-hmm.
And in it, there are a bunch of different categories of, you know, what they excluded. And if you look on page JA 129, it, for example, it says, per review of the provider's psych and rehab admissions report, these are actually psych days and are not counted for DISH purposes. Suggests we disallow these days. This is a Medicare-Medicaid crossover. Suggests we disallow. Now, Medicaid-Medicare crossover, the dual eligible days are controversial, and there are, you know, in certain situations, and there have been disputes about whether such days should be in the Medicare fraction or the Medicaid fraction of the DISH adjustment. Those were one category. Here, these days were paid by Mississippi Medicaid. Mm-hmm. That may not present a legal issue, but there can be, providers can sometimes allege factual errors. If the provider had some data showing that, the intermediary made a mistake about that. I mean, there are a number of categories here that just a simple general reference to Adjustment 49 is not sufficient to put the secretary on notice that this is an appeal of the exclusion of expansion days. And in fact, you know, this court already recognized in Cookeville that although some financial intermediaries were including the expansion waiver population, many, including those in Tennessee, were not. The hospitals were thus on notice that the expansion population might not be included. So they also don't fall within the purpose of this policy. I mean, that the secretary had a longstanding policy not to include the expansion population days up till January 2000, but recognized in 1999 that there was some confusion among intermediaries and hospitals, and some intermediaries actually had been paying hospitals. And those hospitals had a reliance interest for budgeting, et cetera. This plaintiff did not, and this court already noted that in Cookeville, where Baptist Memorial Hospital was a party, and here,
I don't see how the purpose really helps you here. It's just whether they fit within the
yes, no, and you're you, and you don't. You're on. It's certainly sufficient to just look to the plain language of the policy itself, and they don't satisfy that because they filed what is a blank. At the Ninth Circuit just recently considered this in the Phoenix case cited in our brief, and specifically held that a blanket appeal of the DISH calculation before October 15th, 1999 is not sufficient, and the kind of language that the Ninth Circuit cited from the various appeals by the hospitals in that case, I think it are things like the intermediary reduced disproportionate share payments based on Title 19 data obtained from the state. Again, these are general DISH appeals. That hospital might have meant to include expansion waiver days, but it might not have. It's just not clear from that type of language. And We have the same situation here, and the courts have uniformly upheld the Secretary's decisions on this issue.
You say uniformly. How many circuits are you talking about?
Three, Your Honor. We have an Eighth Circuit case in United Hospital versus Thompson, Ninth Circuit in Phoenix Memorial Hospital versus Sebelius, and the Seventh Circuit in the Rush University Medical Center. Yeah.
Ms. Marcus, I don't know if I understood correctly the import of something you said to the effect, if I understood it, to the effect that a party claiming or seeking the hold harmless benefit is expected to provide greater specificity in the notice. Is that true?
I'm distinguishing between the ability to go forward with your appeal and raise certain issues, what the policy was trying to do was, again, to distinguish those hospitals who genuinely thought they had a right to these payments, and there had to be some kind of objective evidence of this.
Why do you need greater notice of that? Why more specificity in the notice?
Because otherwise you could have a hospital just say, I don't think the intermediary calculated any of these issues.
Well, it's going to get fleshed out, right, once the...
But they could, if they add the issue, then it, could be once they know about this, they're trying to take advantage of something and they didn't have, because once the Secretary announced it in October 1999, it was a reasonable cutoff date to set, because that's when the Secretary first announced the policy, and that was the date of the letter to the Senate Finance Committee. But the appeal itself needs to give some indication. And here, again, the amount cited actually cuts against the provider. Seems like they couldn't be appealing the expansion waiver day issue.
Do you agree, though, that the expansion waiver days is an issue within the scope of the calculation of the disproportionate share adjustment? Or, in other words, does the disproportionate share adjustment encompass the calculation of expansion waiver days?
Yes, but adjustment 49 doesn't, because it didn't actually...
Right, but both things are listed in that paragraph, and if it's encompassed within, to follow up on Judge Ginsburg's question, it seems like it's within, it's noticed, and like a lot of appeals in other areas of the law, you flesh out the particulars in further documents, as they did, right?
Well, Your Honor, again, I think that the program memorandum on its face precludes
On its face could have been a little more specific. Because it just says issue, it could have, like the rules do now, it could have specified...
But it says on the issue of the exclusion of these types of days mm-hmm. from the Medicaid DSH formula, it easily could have said a jurisdictionally proper appeal on the DSH formulation. Mm-hmm. It says on the issue of the exclusion of these types of days. And the reason for that is there are all sorts of DSH calculation appeals that providers might take. And Right. So it was very important for the Secretary. Again, the purpose was to distinguish between hospitals that had a reliance interest and those that didn't, and the ones who specifically were appealing exclusion of expansion days or had even received payment. And it also, I think the program memorandum...
We have reached the end of your time.
Yes,
unless my colleagues have further questions, we'll give Mr. Pittler back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, and we'll rest on our briefs on the second
Thank
issue.
You,
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. Okay, let's be very clear here.
And brief.
Yeah, I understand. The work paper you just talked about, okay? The work paper shows no expansion waiver days. This hospital included expansion waiver days in the as-filed cost report. Every case the government has cited, Rush, Phoenix, United, none of those hospitals included the days at issue. They weren't even expansion waiver days. They were state-only days where the state pays for the day without any federal money. None of them included in the as-filed cost report. None of them had an audit adjustment that showed no counting of the expansion waiver days. What the government is saying, well, the intermediary didn't list here that they didn't include something. That's a negative, trying to prove a negative. The record shows that the hospital was required to submit a new list of days without the expansion waiver days. That's what this work paper is auditing. It's auditing the 9,163 10-care traditional days identified by the state of Tennessee. Now, so the cases cited are irrelevant because this hospital did what it was supposed to do. At the time it filed its cost report, there was no policy prohibiting the inclusion of these days. That didn't come about until 1996. It's all in our brief. Next. Reliance. That's a complete misunderstanding of the program memorandum. The program memorandum has two pathways to the inclusion of the days. One, it was reliance. The other was appealing the issue. Those are two separate pathways.
But as Ms. Marcus said, the issue of the exclusion of these types of days, and
it doesn't,
that's not quite
specified. Well, but Audit Adjustment 49 excludes days, including expansion waiver days. Let me just read a very brief.
Go ahead, as long
JA 110. I understand. I understand, Your Honor. I've done this long enough. I know. JA 110 is a letter from the hospital to the intermediary. It says, We've removed the days associated with psych and rehab admissions. I have also reviewed the admissions and removed the crossover claims which were included. It is simply not credible to argue that they would have appealed the removal of those days. They removed them themselves. This is 1994. This is before the issuance of 97-2. This is long ago.
I understand that you're saying that there's not a notice requirement per se, but it does seem that this is awfully deep into the file, away from the original filing that says we're appealing it, number 49. And you say, well, they should be able to have figured out that that was the days that fell within this exception, because if they had gone and looked at these other several documents, they would have come to that conclusion.
Well, Your Honor, you're looking at this from a program memorandum issued in December of 1999. This is a 1994 cost report where the appeal was filed.
That's inherent in the nature of the program. I understand your point there. It's kind of all a hall of mirrors because it's retroactive, but.
But all it says, you had to have appealed the. One final thought, Your Honor. I understand your reticence, believe me, but you had to have appealed the exclusion of expansion waiver days. This hospital included expansion waiver days in its as-filed cost report. The audit adjustment excludes all expansion waiver days. There's not a single one in there.
Right.
The one last thing is
That gets us here. If they hadn't excluded it, we wouldn't have this fight.
The one last thing that the government said that you must understand is the government said, well, when they filed their position paper in November of 99, it was for a lot more money. By November of 99, the number of expansion waiver days at issue had changed. The hospital, when it filed the cost report, had only identified 811 because it was a new program. The state, during the audit, identified 2020. We're dealing with two completely different values of those days. The one that matters is the one that the hospital filed in its as-filed cost report that the audit adjustment excluded. And it's bare on its face that that's what took place here. Thank you for the extra time, Your Honor.
Well past the time.
This is my swan song. Thank you.
We don't normally break after each case, but today, because of logistical reasons involving the difference in crowds wishing to attend the different arguments, we're going to break after each case. So we'll take a brief recess.